This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to an informal workshop on growing food indoors and just growing food generally. My guest in the studio is Philip Beer, owner of Home Harvest Farms in Vancouver, Canada. His company makes durable and portable container garden equipment. Philip also teaches sustainability, and he's active in the local food movement. So we're going to go beyond growing indoors to talk about our general food supply and maybe learn why growing your own food makes so much sense these days. Philip, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be here, Alex.
You've brought in a piece of show-and-tell equipment, but before we talk about that, I'd like to hear a little bit about yourself and how you got into the whole food movement.
My background is engineering technology, and in my early 20s or my 30s, I lived on a kibbutz in Israel, where I lived the life of a farmer, providing mostly technical support to the other farmers and logistical support to the kibbutz village that I was living on. And I've had high hopes for being able to make a difference to climate, to try and shift the trend towards worse symptoms of global warming, of climate change. Some of my work has involved renewable energy. Some of my work has involved community work. But I was feeling frustrated by the lack of progress that those things were bringing as I watched the climate situation getting worse from year to year. I was looking for something that every single person, every child can get involved in that will instantly begin to make a difference to what's going on. And the place where I think we can best do that is by putting our energy into growing food on a local basis when we do that without using chemicals.
Well, you've really caught my attention right away when you say you were providing technical support. I mean, I've been a part-time farmer, let's say, you know, the tractor, some acres, some chickens, some pigs and all that. I didn't have any technical support other than a fellow who helped me fix the tractor occasionally. So what kind of thing were you doing?
Working on the structures within the kibbutz, so taking care of all the systems and the buildings, taking care of the dairy that had about 200 milking cows. So providing logistical support, helping them to build cow sheds and working on tractors. And we took that a step further and started to develop agricultural machinery. And one of the most wonderful inventions that we were able to participate in developing was a system that pasteurizes fruit and vegetables and extends the shelf life of fruit and vegetables using nothing more than hot water.
That sounds amazing. So that technology's out there. How would we find that if we were looking for it?
That's a question that I ask myself, and I don't believe that that technology managed to get out of Israel, even though the farmers who invested in the equipment saw massive returns very, very rapidly on their investments.
That may be an opportunity for someone in North America if they get on board with that. So you came to Canada, you're in Vancouver, and you've started your own business.
That's right. For many years, I've worked in building energy efficiency as one of the things that I did after arriving in Canada. And saw opportunities, felt frustration that we weren't able to really upgrade the stock that we were living in to much more energy efficient buildings, mostly because there wasn't the will either at higher levels or of individuals. But one of the things that I learned there was that we're inhabiting buildings that seem to be warm enough for food, for growing food. And I asked myself the question, well, aren't we missing a fabulous opportunity? What happens if we were to bring food growing into these buildings? And so after asking that question, being the technical person that I am, I started to experiment and prototype, and one thing led to another until I designed a system that was durable and could be used indoors and outdoors for growing food in a compact space.
And there's a little less guilt doing that with lights, I think, in Vancouver, because we don't have any coal plants. We don't have any nuclear plants. It's coming out of hydroelectricity, which is relatively green as long as we don't flood too many more valleys. Well, you brought a system here today. Why don't we talk about that? Because it's not going to use very much energy. What have you got in the bucket here?
Sure. So what I brought for you today is a mini system that is constructed with a number of stainless steel troughs that we fill with soil. And I like to use soil because it creates the opportunity to build microorganism communities that will support growth as much as possible. And I've chosen stainless steel because it landed up after experimenting with different plastic materials and looking at a whole bunch of different choices. Even though stainless steel is a relatively exotic material, from a cost-effectiveness perspective, it's the most effective material that I can use. So these 24-inch planter troughs sit on a stepped platform, and above them we place a fluorescent T5 grow light, and we add plants, we add water, and whatever skills and talents we need in order to nurture the plants. And it enables us on our tabletop or on the floor of our living room to grow food in close proximity to the kitchen where we're going to be using it.
Right. I'd like to grab the fresh herbs that I want. I just used some oregano the other day, and I looked at it, and it was all very dead, very brown, very dry. I don't know how long it had been in this bottle. And I thought, well, I should be able to just pick it off the plant and use it, you know. And the same with basil and all sorts of things. So I'm buying this from you today, and I want to use it. I want to give it a try. I'm thinking of the various things I could grow in it. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, we're all concerned about plastics and whether plastics are leaching into our food at various points. And this is one of the things I like about your stainless steel setup. I don't have to worry about that. Did you look into that? Can plastics get into plant roots and eventually into our food, or do we know?
I'm concerned enough as somebody who's interested in eating food as pure as I can, let's say taking the precautionary principle and saying that it's possible that they can, so why do something that's going to create that option? By using stainless steel, I achieve two things. One of them is I avoid that possibility, and the other is that I've created something that when I'm looking at sustainability, it might be energy intensive to make the stainless steel. But the system that you're going to be buying from me today will probably be with your grandchildren if you have any.
Right. I've had a couple of other metal growing containers and they just rusted out and they're gone. So I hope it will last a long time. I hope to use it for a long time. And then you've got something in the bottom to sort of collect the water, because I know from my own experience in growing that if the roots are sitting in too much wetness, the plant just dies. I mean, that people overwater their plants. That's what kills more houseplants than anything else.
Well, that's right. And so these guys allow the water to escape from the bottom of the planter. And underneath the soil, I place either a thin layer of coconut fiber or, in this case, a plastic inverted tube, or half a tube, and that keeps enough of the root space dry and allows the water to escape freely through the edge of the planter.
Mm-hmm. And now, can you tell us about this light bulb? I mean, some people are not familiar that there are fluorescents that can mimic the sunlight. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
That's correct. So these are the most energy-efficient fluorescence lights that we're able to purchase. And the frequency and intensity has been tweaked. Thankfully, I can say in BC, thanks to the people who've had an interest in growing pot and have been willing to invest large amounts of money in the design of these lighting systems. But they have been optimized for plant growth. And with relatively small amounts of energy, we're able to get good growth from our plants.
Yeah, I was kind of concerned about that because I used fluorescence before myself. But I probably didn't have as good bulbs because I could only sort of get seedlings going, but I couldn't really get You couldn't grow something like a tomato plant under them, for example. Tomato plants just take a lot of light to really produce tomatoes. But I'm going to give these a try and see just how much you can get out of a modern fluorescent.
I've found them to be really impressive lights. And one of the things that I love about them is for a system that has, say, two or three lights, you're probably going to be spending $2 to $4 a month on your vegetables. And to make up that amount of money by not having to purchase it at the store is not too great a challenge.
Yeah, I can grab just a few vegetables at the store and it's already $4 one time. So if I can grow them cheaply, I will. And I'm looking forward to giving that a chance. And then you also make a much bigger unit, a 4-foot-long unit that would hold a lot more soil. I didn't get it because I'm in a condo right now and I just don't have room for it, but I'd love to have it. So do you want to talk to us about what that is?
I've designed a number of systems. The one that you're talking about for yourself is the simplest stepped system. My other systems are designed on a small cart so that they can easily be rolled between inside and outside, and contain three troughs rather than the one that contains just two. And it's been designed in a way that makes it really easy to suspend lights at different heights, because when we're starting seedlings, we want the light to be as close as possible to where the seedlings are. But also to cover the planter with a greenhouse cover, which extends our growing season or gives us the ability to control some of the humidity and to optimize the conditions for growing. Now, I've got those systems in 24-inch wide or 2-foot wide systems. I've also got them in 4-foot wide systems. For the indoor and outdoor systems, those are the dominant options that I have available. There's another whole group of planters that I subsequently developed after seeing that there would be a need for them, and these are movable raised bed planters. One of the things that I'm learning about people who are interested in growing food in the city is that they'll often lose their space for growing within 3 years, which requires that they move from the backyard that they're in, or they move from the empty lot that they're on to someplace else. And I wanted to design a system that could be picked up and put onto a flatbed truck and moved from one place to another without losing the investment in the organic soil and without having to suspend the growing process in some cases. So I have movable raised bed planters in 4 feet and 8 feet lengths. And I also have an interesting one that has a vertical gardening option with 3 8-foot planters, one on top of the other. And those can easily be accessed with a movable ladder. And what I envision is places that are on asphalt or places that are indoors in a warehouse or somewhere like that, where people will be growing food intensively, using lights if necessary, and using vertical space to get the most out of the space that we have.
Those are some amazing ideas, really. To be able to pick up your garden and move it, it is certainly the soil that you would miss the most. But even if you have to move in the middle of the season, somebody sold the house or whatever the story is, you could pick it up with the plants, you're saying, and put it somewhere else and keep on growing.
That's correct. And for somebody who wants to create a garden in a school or in a park, we often find that our initial decision about where to locate things and how to lay out the farm that we have is not ideal, and we may want to tweak it. And what I've done is create the opportunity for people to do things in such a way that allows things to be optimized along throughout the process.
Okay, so before we go on to what's happening with the local food movement in Vancouver, and also I'd like to talk a little bit about my own experience in therapeutic indoor gardening, which is a whole other ball of wax, why don't we at least tell people where to find you and what your website is and give them that information?
Sure. So I'm located in Vancouver, and anybody who's interested in seeing the Home Harvest Farms website should go to www.homeharvestfarms.com. And it's probably best if you repeat that, because most people don't understand my English.
Okay, well, I understood it pretty clearly. It's homeharvestfarms.com, right?
That's great.
Okay, and we can look you up on Facebook as well?
I am on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter as Home Harvest Farm. So no S in the Twitter address.
Okay, I think we've got that. This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Philip Beer, and that name is spelled B-E-apostrophe-E-R. We're chatting about growing food indoors under lights and much more. Let's move on, Philip, to talking about your sustainability workshops. What are you doing there?
What I'm hoping to work with people on is the opportunities presented by growing food for reducing our carbon emissions by 70%. And while there are a billion different good reasons for growing food, and these include our health, access to fresh, pesticide-free food, one of the things that's overlooked is the advantages when we do grow things organically and locally of reducing carbon emissions associated with the food. Most of the energy that goes into growing our food is in the pesticides and the herbicides and the chemicals that are needed for growing the food on the farm. And from the moment that we take that out of the process and we grow organically, we've massively reduced the footprint of what it is that we're growing. But we also have large amounts of energy going in and coming out of the process, associated with how we distribute the food to some degree, and all of the packaging and processing that goes into the food that we have. So the closer that we can bring the food to the people who are going to be eating it, and the less we process that, the less energy needs to go into it. And there's almost nothing else that human beings can shift in our lifestyles without radically going back to simplicity. There's almost nothing more effective than growing our own food. It's something with very little investment in both materials and time that everybody, including a young child, can do to help to combat climate change.
Right. So even if you don't have economic worries, which I do, I think the economy's not going very well. Even if you're suspicious of the current food supply, and I'll bet we both are, we know what's happening to it. Things are being poisoned on the farm, and then they're being shot full of things to make them last longer till they get to where we are. But even getting rid of all those ideas, we still have the climate change responsibility. And as you say, we can make some big changes just by learning to grow our own food or helping other people who are growing our own food.
That's absolutely correct. And in the process of doing so, we get all of the benefits that you've just described by not sourcing our food in ways that are damaging to our health and our well-being. But interesting things start to happen when we are growing our own food, and they start to shift the way that we organize ourselves as a society. So one of the things that is difficult for people in North America to do is to share. But the moment we are growing food, we find that we tend to have either a surplus that we want to share with someone, we have to give stuff away or throw it away. And because we grew it ourselves, our tendency is not to throw it away. But we also rapidly run into the challenge of not having enough knowledge because some new pest or some new challenge occurs. And then we become dependent on people to help us resolve these challenges. And very quickly, we find that we're becoming more and more a part of a community of people who are doing similar things. And without knowing it, by exchanging knowledge, by exchanging things that we've grown, we also begin to construct an economy that's a local economy and that is much more robust, potentially, than the economy that is the dominant economy that we're living in.
I'm wondering, too, what have you found that is most interesting to you about the local food movement in Vancouver? I mean, it's pretty active here. A lot of things, the 100-mile diet, very many things have started in Vancouver. I found it a real hotbed of ideas, but what's attracted your interest here?
I'm excited by the level of innovation and motivation. And one of the most exciting projects, because of its large scale, because of its boldness, is a project called Soul Food Farms. They were innovative in the way that they were able to get access to undeveloped land where the person contributing the land got tax benefits from the city by lending their land to Soul Food. Soul Food has demonstrated the scalability of urban farming by putting into place a container garden with somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 12-inch deep containers above asphalt. And they're farming it with people who would not otherwise be able to get regular work. So what they're doing is bringing together people who are looking for employment with available employment. And they're prototyping ways that we can grow our food much more intensively on what people might call brownfield. Soul Food is showing us what can be done on brownfield sites. And they're doing it on a very large scale.
Right. I saw pictures from last year, I think it was, outside the stadium where they play football. And they'd been given a large area of a parking lot. And bang, there it was, an urban farm. And they had all kinds of people employed and all kinds of produce coming out of it.
So their site, they're using between 2 and 3 acres of that site. And there's a lot more land available there. And I'm not sure what the details of that's limiting their use of the entire space. But one of the other beautiful things that we get to see is a demonstration of growing things without mechanization. So the amount of fuel that they're using to run their operation approaches zero. One of the beautiful things that I love about it is their ability to distribute the food to farmers markets and to restaurants using a couple of small vehicles rather than having to truck it across the nation. I don't think they use very much refrigeration at all. They're associated with people who are doing deliveries of food within the city by bicycle.
Well, the good news is, Philip Baer, that this is happening in many cities in the world now. I just spoke with Rashid Nouri this week about a big operation that's happening of urban farming in Atlanta, Georgia. We've heard from Victory Garden Movement that's happening in Chicago that's been very successful. Detroit has gotten people out there where houses have been torn down. They've got tractors running. They're starting to grow. So I think this is a movement whose time has come. We're going to stop buying beans that were shipped in from Chile by air and getting things that were really grown locally. So a lot of good things to talk about there. I did want to share with listeners some of my own history about growing things indoors. I'd have to reveal a little bit about myself. I had a couple of serious spinal operations on my neck. I ended up in bed. I couldn't move very much. And I'm kind of a beach guy. I had been sort of almost a surfer at one point, so sunlight was very important to me. We had to move to a bad part of town because I was out of work. And what do you know, we ran into somebody who had to sell their grow-op equipment right quick. I guess he was on his way out of town for some reason. So I got to buy in with a couple of other people, several grow lights for a couple hundred bucks, and did so. Well, I mounted a 600-watt bulb on a kind of a swing-out piece of wood over my bed and painted the whole room yellow. And in fact, the room we're in now is painted yellow as well. But it really helped. You know, I mean, this thing was so bright, you pretty well had to wear sunglasses. You had to have a ballast on the bottom to run it, and you had to make sure your wiring was really good. In fact, I had an electrician come in and run a separate wire from our fuse box to where I was going to run these lights, because this is what happens to grow-ups all over Vancouver, is they catch fire because they don't do their wiring right and pay attention to the load that these things are going to draw. And what happens with the big bulbs, I also got 2,000-watt bulbs, is they use most of their power when they're starting up to get the ballast going, just as fluorescents do. But then they actually use less than, if you have a 1,000-watt bulb, it's not drawing 1,000 watts after the ballast has been heated up and gets going. So you plug it in, you turn it on, you wait for 2 or 3 minutes before you actually get the light that you're going to get out of it. It just slowly builds up and builds up. Anyway, I found it very therapeutic to have this light on. I would have it on almost every rainy gray day and get some sunshine back in my life. It helped me a little bit. It also dried out the room quite a bit, which was important to me because I had arthritis. So, you know, it warmed things up, heated them up, made me feel better. Well, when I was able to get up and around, we had a basement room that wasn't being used. I had been, as I said, a part-time farmer. I was anxious to just do something and grow something. I didn't want to grow pot because I don't like jails and I don't want to go to jail, so I didn't do that. What I did do, though, was set up a couple of fluorescent lights at the time to get my seedlings going for the various things I wanted to grow. I wanted to grow tomatoes, I wanted to grow lettuce, that sort of thing. I tried some squash, that didn't work out as well, but that's another story. And set up the 600-watt bulb and the 1,000-watt bulb going over some tables, and I had it set up in such a way, as you say, you need to have the plant leaves near the light for it to really work. So when things were small, they'd be up on these tables near the light, but then I could drop them down a little bit, and then I also had the lights on chains suspended from the ceiling so that I could just move up the chain links to move the lights up when I needed to. And I had them kind of double suspended, just using clothesline, two hooks, but I had a second sort of safety line in there in case the first one went, because you don't want those lights to crash. That's another fire hazard. So you put a safety in so that that isn't going to happen to you. Things grew amazingly well, and to go into that room was just as much fun as you can imagine. You had to put your sunglasses on. I used UV-coated sunglasses just to protect my eyes, but I put on a little ocean music while I was doing my gardening. I could hear the waves crashing in the background, and it was just brightened every minute of my day. I still smile thinking about going in there and doing that gardening and having that fun. So I'm just offering that out to listeners to say that in addition to being able to pick your own ripe tomatoes in the darkest December and getting your own fresh lettuce, and you can't beat that, there's a goodness for your heart possible in this, so long as you're not powering those lights burning coal or nuclear fuel. So keep that in mind. Where's your power coming from? But if it's from a decent source, or if you can set up your own solar panels, even better. So there's another way to grow things too, I'm saying, and that is to use big grow lights and have a lot of fun. And so what's your take on that?
I loved listening to you telling your story. One of the things that we haven't spoken about is what's happening with the global food system. Because I am concerned with all of the droughts and the flooding and the things that seem to be bringing the system to a place where it's not dependable anymore, is increasing horticultural literacy among both children and adults as rapidly as possible, and supporting the rapid diffusion of knowledge so that we can know as a society how to take care of ourselves. And one of the challenges that I think that we're going to be facing is the need to rapidly expand locally grown food, but we're not going to have seeds available for doing that when people en masse approach West Coast Seeds and places like that to say, guys, I need to be growing something for my family to eat. Or when we start looking for nutrient materials so that we can grow food in soil, but the natural occurring soil is contaminated or is not suitable for growing things. I encourage people to do the kind of experimentation and to grow the kind of garden that you were describing in whatever space they have, whether it's inside or outside, so that we develop the demand and we develop the tools as rapidly as possible to weather whatever kind of climate storms are coming our way.
You raise a really, really good point. I mean, we're thinking about the drought that's happening in the Midwest, and that's still continuing into this winter, incidentally, of the United States. Britain is sort of flooded out. I don't know how their farm crop is going to come this year. It all depends on whether it dries out enough in the spring, whether they can get into the fields. Australia, as we know, had just record burning heat and forest fires to go with it. And we're just at the start of this. We're at the very start of climate change. We've hardly had anything yet, not to mention the storms and the hailstorms and the tornadoes and all of that. So the kind of product that you're selling, and we're talking with Philip Baer of homeharvestfarms.com, you said to me, well, okay, nobody's going to feed themselves from this little system, but they are going to learn how, and the knowledge is going to spread. And if I learn how, it might spread through my family. And so it's a start.
That's correct. And with the larger systems that I've developed, what I'm looking at is being able to deploy food growing containers above asphalt, above contaminated ground, and basically above cityscapes. And this may include rooftops, it may be the parking lots above malls, and it might just be above the ground. But the beauty of the style of system that I've been working on is that it uses a very small amount of nutrient and a very small amount of soil and water to create growing environments very, very rapidly. So if I were to receive an order from a city like the city of Vancouver for 10,000 of these units, we would be able to put these on the boulevards and on the unused streets of the city. And with enough educated people, enough soil and enough seeds, we could be growing huge amounts of food in the city within a very short period of time.
And you've mentioned, though, one of the weak spots could be the seeds. What are we going to do about that?
That is something that by having this conversation, hopefully people will be listening to what we're talking about and seeing the opportunities for doing something with that. But if nobody comes up with some way of dealing with that aspect of the climate crisis and the peak oil crisis and the population crisis that are all converging right now, it's an end game for human beings potentially.
Well, we're going to have to be more than growers. We're going to have to be seed savers as well. And there's techniques to be learned, but it's not that hard. People have been doing it for thousands of years. So I guess we have to take on that mantle as well.
That is probably one of the most important roles for people in our society today who want to make a valuable contribution.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time, Philip. I'm wondering if there's other things that you'd like to talk with us about.
The one thing that's on my mind is a concern about the agricultural lands proximate to Vancouver that are being threatened by rising sea levels. where already we're starting to see water infiltrating, saltwater infiltrating and destroying our ability to grow food in these places. These are Richmond and Delta and parts of the Fraser Valley. And before we lose that rich agricultural land, I would love to see these cities adopting forms of agriculture that raise the agriculture above the ground using systems like the style of system that I've designed, because I believe that we're going to need to be eating food from as close by as possible. And it would be a terrible shame to lose both these places and the fertile soil that's there today.
You know, I've looked into that, and this is a problem in many places where we broadcast. San Francisco is one for sure, because salinity could work its way all the way up to Sacramento through the water system they've got there. It's a big problem. Rising seas is a threat, and of course, the storm surges that drive them. We've got the same thing going on in Chesapeake Bay. That's a big agricultural area, and a lot of good growing land could be lost. And when we look around the world, we find out that the best growing lands are in river deltas right by the sea. That's where a large part of the world population is currently located. So we've got to stop climate change before it wipes out our agricultural capabilities, or millions will starve. And it's possible millions will starve anyway, but we hope not, and we're going to try and prevent this from happening. And as you've told us today, growing your own food is something that each of us can do to lower the climate threat. So I want to thank you very much for coming by and stopping in and talking with us today. Our guest has been Philip Baer. He's with homeharvestfarms.com here in Vancouver. You can find that on the internet and look at the products that some of which, did you invent some of those products?
All of those have been designed by me. All of the soil-based products have been designed by me.
Right. Okay. So he's worked it up himself, and I think we've got some original material here that some of you will be interested in. Thank you so much for listening. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.